Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division for Wednesday, February 13th will come to order. Tomorrow is Valentine's Day, so don't forget to get your honeys some roses, you guys. And we'll get started with the continuation of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency overview. Kirk, are you up first? Do you want to go first, or how do you want to do this?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm actually going to turn over my colleague. He has the beginning slides, and I follow.
Do we need
that cleanup form?
Do we need full disclosure here as to these Muellers? Are they related here, or is there no relation?
Distant.
No.
Mr. Chair and senators, members, we'll start. We'll jump right in.
Lyle, say your name for the record, please.
My name is Lyle Mueller. I'm the finance manager for the MPCA, and the slide that we're going to start with is illustrates our mix of funding over a 10-year window, including what we're requesting or asking for in 14 and 15. A couple of things to just take note of is you can see that the kind of the bottom color slice of the bar chart is the general fund, and noting how that is a funding source for our agency has decreased over a period of time. Now, when you look at three fiscal years, fiscal 7, 8, and 9, that was the beginning of funding for the Clean Water Legacy activities, but from the general fund. Beginning in fiscal 10, that's the transition to the Clean Water Fund, and so you'll see a new segment of the bar chart, which is that orange color, shows up for the first time in fiscal 10, and then continues to the current. This is the fifth and sixth year of funding from the Clean Water Fund.
What's the total on it? Oh, there it is. Okay, you got it on the next slide. That's okay.
So, looking at our full expenditure budget of $379 million, the two slices of this particular funding pie that we just want us to touch on and spend a few more minutes are the two major pieces are the environmental fund, the green slice at 38%, and the remediation fund at 18%. And where I want to just give you a little more information is the source of revenue to those two separate funds. Next. In the environmental fund, you'll see that a major source of receipts to the environmental fund is the solid waste management tax that makes up 56% of the inflow into the fund. The next category are the fees paid by our regulated parties, 28%. And members, we did hand out an additional one-page sheet on that breaks that down into a little more detail, and you get a sense of the amount paid by air, hazardous waste, pollution prevention, electronic waste or e-waste, and then the range of water quality fees.
Are these fees then used for specific purposes within the MPCA, or are they just used as a general part of managing MPCA?
Mr. Chair and members, all of these fees with one exception being the Metro Landfill Abatement Fee, which is on the pie chart at 3%. All of the other fees come into the fund in what we call as non-dedicated receipts, which means they become a blend of resources in the fund, and then are used, you know, through the appropriation process, fund the various activities across the agency.
Do any of these fees then end up in the general fund?
No. Mr. Chair, no, they do not.
Okay.
Moving on to the remediation fund, the characterization of the resources in the remediation fund is a little bit different in that there are two major transfers of resources that basically provide the resources in this particular fund. You'll see that the transfer of resources from the environmental fund to the remediation fund makes up 63% of what becomes available within the fund. And in addition, a somewhat smaller transfer from the petroleum fund comes to the remediation fund. The remaining fees and other receipts are things like there's a slice that relates to the metro landfill fee comes into the fund. There's dry cleaners fees. There are cost recovery receipts that come from doing remediation work and billing the responsible parties, both in Superfund, the voluntary cleanup program, and a few other minor categories.
For the record, the quorum is present.
Next slide comes back to our just a view of our overall expenditure budget, again, $379 million, and kind of how that's arrayed by fund. And again, just as an update, currently our general fund is becoming a relatively small piece of our funding picture at 3%, Clean Water Fund at 14%, and kind of continuing around the pie. So questions on our distribution of funding sources.
So with the small amount of general fund money and the clean water fund, environmental fund, all the rest of them fees? No, federal funds are not fees, right?
Mr. Chair, the general fund, you know, that's pretty well understood.
Right.
Clean water fund, again, pretty well understood. When you get to the environmental fund, remember that's the fund that's made up of first the solid waste management tax at 56%, additional fees from regulated parties at 28%. So that slice, the expenditure slice of 38%, is really made up of a combination of solid waste management tax and the fees from regulated parties. Those are the two big sources there.
And who are the regulated parties?
Mr. Chair, they would be.
That's that group here.
Back to that list.
All right. Okay. I'm starting to follow now. Okay. Okay. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification for me. If we look at the two charts that we have at the top of the page, and we go by fund, the environmental fund, $143.6 million, and over at the funding sources, the environmental fund, $179.2 million, where does that difference wind up?
Mr. Chair, Senator, if you think about $180 million, roughly, coming into the environmental fund, you know, in this two-year period, then we are going to turn around and we're going to transfer about $40 million of that $180 to the remediation fund. So what it does is it leaves that difference to be available for expenditure.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And are any of the federal funds that we get, are they based on any of Minnesota's funds? In other words, do we get certain federal funds because we do something in Minnesota, or why do we get the federal funds?
Mr. Chair, a good portion of our, or a significant portion of our federal funds are tied to functions or activities that have been delegated from the EPA to the state of Minnesota, to the Pollution Control Agency. It's almost as if we become an agent, if I can use that term, for the EPA. So there are programs that are operated at the state level, where it's almost like thinking that the funding or that becomes the reason that it's funded the way it is from the feds. In addition, then there are a variety of individual federal grants that that we apply for that are almost operate almost more like projects, you know, individual projects. So it is a combination. The next slide, again, that our same total expenditure budget of $379 million, just arrayed by our five budget programs. Again, you can see, as it has for a number of years, our water program is the largest, almost a third of our expenditure budget. And questions on the relative size or ratio of our budget programs. From there, we'll...
Mr. Chair?
So the Senator Saxon, go ahead.
Well, I don't know when the right time to ask this is going to be, but the part, you know, when we start talking about northern Minnesota and permitting, the question always is... I'm assuming, and I've watched your operation, so I think that you're running pretty much at 100% full bore. You know, you're doing what you should be doing. But first question is would more money allow you to permit more quickly? And if so, where would be the best place to get that money in?
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxhog, that's a good question. A lot of times when folks look at our permitting efficiency numbers.
Say your name for the record, please.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Kirk Kadelko with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It's a good question. A lot of folks look at our numbers and efficiency, and I wonder if just adding money will solve it. It's not that simple. In some cases, yes. And one example is our air permit program. Right now, when someone turns in an air permit, we have a queue, a waiting station list. Right now, it's about three or four projects. And so more money could get those more workers to start on those. However, once it gets into the process, once a modeler or a permit writer has been assigned, it's just what needs to be done. More money doesn't necessarily speed that up. And so what we've done is that the agency has two agency-wide permitting continuous improvement efforts to help in that area where money isn't the answer. So we will be looking at some of those simpler permits using our general permits, much like we do the construction stormwater. You go on the website, you apply, you can get your permit back in 2 and 7 days. Those are low environmental risk permits, and we're able to turn them around quicker. We're looking at other permits that we can do in a similar fashion so they're turned around quicker, so we can shift resources to the more complex and controversial projects to move them along quicker. So that's one of our continuous improvement process. The other is some of those techniques that our commissioner mentioned, the lien programs. We have gone through and looked at all the different forms for applications and tried to standardize them. Now we're going into and looking at how the process, internal process we use to do the permitting efforts to see where we might be able to streamline them or standardize them. Yeah. You know, what type of checks and balances we use. Each of our programs are a little different, so there are some best management practices that one program may have discovered that the other isn't using, and we're hoping in that way we can make a leaner, more streamlined system that still protects the environment and public health and get at some of those days, and that's how we can do it with a non-monetary way, and that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you're telling us here, I hope, is and something that we've been working on for the last couple of years, and you have, is that it isn't the cookie cutter approach when there are obvious permits that have been done over and over again and are, for lack of a better word, simpler than the rest, that you try to do them post haste and the tough ones, you know that you're going to be spending more time and money on. Is that not everything's the same?
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxhog, you're correct. No two permits are alike. And where they are, we try to standardize them and get out the door quickly, depending on their risk.
And I thought I heard you say that those are the ones that are not money-dependent in the agency or something to that effect. you don't need extra money to get that done because you're going to computerize them? Is that what I heard you say?
Mr. Chair, that's one of the avenues we're going to do. We'll talk about some change items. We are, in our permitting areas, specifically air and water, seeing some pressures. We'll talk about a little bit more where dollars will help, but it's not the only answer. Just increasing the amount of funding doesn't get a faster permit necessarily.
What does?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that's a good question. I think a proposer doing their homework beforehand, one of the best ways we've seen really is if they're out there working with their community, and a lot of our regulated parties do that. They go out there, explain their process to their neighbors, explain it to the community so they understand, listen to their concerns before it gets to us, and then we can move it along quite quickly. If they keep us in the loop while they're developing the project, we can help steer them in a direction that's more efficient for permitting. The ones that take a long time are those that just drop it on a community at last minute, drop it on us at last minute, and are really set in stone on what they want to do. And that's where it becomes more difficult for us to get them through the permitting process. And then it also brings public interest and controversy to the issue, which adds time. So I think that those are some of the ways that could speed up that are outside the agency's control.
To Senator Saxog's concern, are more people at the agency level dealing with the permitting process a possibility of speeding up permitting? Or are you adequately staffed?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we will, in our change items, talk about two areas in our air and water program where we do see additional pressure, where additional staff will be needed, and we have proposed for that. Right now, through our internal process, whenever someone leaves a position in the agency, we go back and reprioritize what that person will be. So just because you leave a position doesn't mean that automatically be filled. And so we do a lot of internal work to determine if we need more permit writers. For instance, a year ago, we hired 5 new air permit writers because there was a loss in that area. So we do some internal shuffling, but there are some needs for more resources, and we'll get to them in a little bit.
Continue on.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it's now back to me. Before you, you'll see our 5 budget areas: air, land, water, cross-media environmental assistance, and administration. There's a packet there that I just want to quickly talk about. Inside there, you'll see our performance measures. The commissioner mentioned that we do use a number of performance measures. This packet really is to give you an understanding of what our base budget does, what the results we're achieving as a result of it, so you understand when you're looking at our base budget what you're buying for services-wise in a general term, on environmental outcomes and our efficiencies. I'm going to refrain from going through that line by line and just focus on the change items because we could spend a lot of time in each of those areas. But there is information including where in those programs we get a collection of funds. What I would like to focus on is a smaller document, which is our biennial budget fact sheet, which covers the change items that I'll be talking about next. So the first area we're going to focus on is the air program. The first initiative here is one that appears in every budget. Under the Federal Clean Air Act, the fees do have a system built in so inflation is accounted for to help with the cost of program. It's already worked in the formula. These fee increases are linked to the Consumer Price Index under federal law. The increases have occurred already, and the regulated parties have paid them. What we're asking to do with this is it goes into the environmental fund, and unless the legislature appropriates those dollars to us, we cannot use them. So this is a technical item that appears in all of our budget for the last several years. The next is the air program appropriation that we talked about just a little bit earlier. We are requesting from the Environmental Fund $1.5 million.
Just go back to that.
Sorry.
The one before. Are you going to get specific about who pays the fees?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is for anyone who pays an annual emissions fee. So anyone who pays because of the amount of emissions that are released from their facility, it's a formula that's already incorporated. Is it in there?
No, we don't.
Okay. So it's anyone who gets an air permit currently with us. There's a Title V air permit.
And so they pay a fee every single year?
Correct, Mr. Chair. They pay an annual fee based on the amount of emissions they emit. And that's set up under the Federal Clean Air Act.
Shouldn't the amount that they pay go down?
It is set up so that we'll cover the expense of our permitting program. So it does stay fairly level. And there are these built into it, the inflation costs built into the program. So they do, those two tend to go up.
So our air emissions aren't going down then, is that what you're saying?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's what needs to be collected, the pot of money, it's distributed through a formula on those emissions that are emitted. But it is figured with a lump amount that needs to be met. So depending on what the what regulated parties are out there and what the emissions mix is, an individual person, it may go down. If, for instance, a company puts on new technology which reduces their air emissions, they're going to pay less. However, the overall system is still collecting the same amount of money. It's much like property tax levies.
That scared me.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the next is our air program appropriation, where we are asking, and this is from the Environmental Fund, an extra $1.5 million. In 2009, the legislature passed and told the agency that we needed to work on an application fee, which is separate from that other fee that I just talked about. I know this is gets nuanced, to cover the cost of when someone comes to the agency with their permit, to cover that initial work on the beginning of their five-year permit cycle, and that includes environmental review. As a result of the legislature's requirements, the agency put together a rulemaking that set up a point system to score, depending on the amount of work of that application, amount of an application fee. Those dollars have been deposited into the Environmental Fund for the last several years. They have not been used. What we're asking here is the authority to spend those dollars. So by passing this initiative does not increase fees. It just allows the agency to spend the money that's already being collected. And so what we would like to use these dollars for are some of those pressures that we are seeing. As the commissioner mentioned, we have a 17-year-old database system that's behind our permitting system that needs to be replaced. We have done a good job of squirreling away some money from current funds that we're receiving to help with the initial work on that, but there will need to be additional work that this will help fund. And one of those areas is it takes more than just IT folks to build the system. Some of our permit program folks will need to be a part of the process and, as a result, be taken off the line of producing permits. Some of these funding will be then used to backfill those positions to make sure we provide the same level of service on the permitting area. A second area is our backlog. Currently, as you know, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency prioritizes priority permits, those construction permits that allow new businesses to move forward. And as a result, we put on the back burner and get to what we can, renewal permits. That doesn't stop a company from operating. When a permit is up for renewal, they can continue to operate. The protections that are there for public health and the environment are still there. We just have not been able to get to the paperwork and update it as needed. Right now, we're at a 55% backlog. The federal government, EPA, and ourselves have a goal of 10%. And so some of these resources will help us get that backlog down to that more manageable level of 10%. Also, we anticipate with the economy, again on the uptick, that we will have more permits coming in. Instead of being behind the curve and have staff available after the fact when we see those permits come in, some of these dollars will allow for us to be able to react and not have large waiting lists be created. The next initiative for the air program is $900,000 per year from the Environmental Fund for improving air quality. As was mentioned earlier and the commissioner mentioned, we in the state have done a good job to keep under the health standards for air, but we are very close. And we have asked the traditional sources, the point sources, the smokestacks that you see in the horizon to do their fair share, and they have done a very good job. While there's still work to be there, the bulk of our work is on non-point sources. It's small businesses, it's our homes, it's the vehicles we travel with on the roads or off-roads, whether it's a snowmobile or our lawnmowers. These are the pollution sources that are really the bulk of our contribution right now. And what we'd like to do is work on a voluntary effort to reduce those emissions from widespread and small sources. We've been meeting with a coalition of groups under the Clean Air Dialogues that's being administered by the Environmental Initiative that includes the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Center of Environmental Advocacy, ourselves, and many other stakeholders. It's a unique and diverse group that has recently put together a number of proposals to reduce those non-point sources. This money will act as a seed and beginning money to start implementing some of those measures. It is not all the money that will be needed to get that effort and to get at that non-point sources. The Clean Air Dialogues are looking at other funding sources, but this is a start of those efforts.
Senator Saxhawk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudalka, on non-point source air pollution or whatever, air quality, what are some good examples of cars or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxhawk, on the area sources, some of them include various functions such as automobile and auto finishing, commercial cleaners and that send off VOCs, which contribute to ozone, diesel backup generators. If we could move them to less polluting fuels, whether it's biodiesel or others, that could reduce emissions. Those are voluntary efforts we would look forward to. And then for mobile sources, we've had Project Green Fleet in the state, which has retrofitted school buses and those diesel engines so that they're more efficient and also less polluting. There are other classes of larger vehicles, construction equipment, snow plows. If we can get those diesel equipment to be more efficient and less polluting, we can get at those non-point sources. And those are some of the areas through voluntary programs we'd like to go through.
Thank you.
And this, so is this $900,000 a fee also? Or?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this does not require a fee increase. This is accessing the dollars that are already in the environmental fund and allowing us to spend them. This money is already being collected in the fund. We're just asking to be able to use it.
So this is something you haven't used it for before? Or?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we've used it in very small amounts. We would really like to increase our effort in this area on voluntary efforts.
How would you use it? Would this be advertising or education, or what would this be?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that's a good question. Some of it could be that way, changing some of our behaviors. For instance, bad air quality days in the metropolitan area. Letting folks know you shouldn't be mowing your lawn at that time because you're contributing to the problem at a greater degree. But if we can use some efforts to help some of these other businesses, whether it's a paint shop or that, to use chemicals that have less byproducts, toxic or hazardous byproducts from it that get into the atmosphere, that could save them money and reduce their needs for permits, that's one effort. So we can outreach to them. Some of it will be assistance dollars that could be used. We could help with, like Project Green Fleet, help provide dollars to local governments to retrofit their snow plows. So it is going to be a mix of many different things that the Clean Air Dialogue has proposed and are finalizing.
Okay. Question? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudalka, would you please try and explain it a little bit better when you talk about you're going to try and educate folks to not mow their lawns at certain times of the day. Could you expound on that a little bit? Seriously.
Yeah.
Snow blowers and whatnot.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, there are certain dates out each year, and they come across the news, especially in the metro area, a lot less in your part of the state, where there are health advisories out there because of the amount of pollutants that are kind of massed over the Twin Cities. And so not to make that worse, what you could do is mow your lawn tomorrow instead of the date that occurs. Simple things like that can have great impacts on the health benefits to the area. We're not telling you not to mow your yard. Just wait a day. And those are voluntary efforts that we can do to help with the health.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, we have to develop an app for the iPhone to let us know when the air is bad so that we know when not to mow. That should work, right?
I think so. Huh? Well, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that's coming. I mean, that, with the technology, I mean.
We probably got one. Who knows?
We probably got it already. Keeping up with the texting.
Yeah, we're too old for
just
that.
It needs to be explained a little bit.
Senator Dibble.
We get it.
Thanks. I do know that the agency does send out an email if you sign up for it. So with the health advisories, I'm a runner. I try to avoid running on those days because you can really tell the difference.
Oh, yeah.
Makes you feel pretty bad when you run, breathe that air.
Yeah, we don't have that problem up north, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm going to move next to our land programs. And the first one I would like to talk about is product stewardship efforts. The agency, through its solid waste policy report, identified a number of problem materials under statute. Problem materials are categorized for a number of reasons. One, they may be toxic. Two, they may cause various unique problems in the waste stream for proper disposal or recycling of them. And so we have identified a few of them, and we would like to move forward on three specific ones dealing with paint, carpet, and primary batteries. Primary batteries are batteries in hearing aids or your remote controls or your kids' toys to collect those. The program will work with a private-public partnership where those manufacturers of those products would be responsible for the end-of-life proper disposal and recycling of those materials. Right now, some of that's haphazard. We do have some counties have programs to pick this up, but this would allow for increased collection of these materials. An example is paint. Currently, $5 to $6 million are being spent by local units of government to collect and properly dispose of paint, but that's not collecting all of it out there. The product, because of it, its nature, is also banned from landfills, so we need a proper way to take care of it. Other states and the industry have come together and created a product stewardship program for paint, where a product stewardship organization is created by the paint industry that helps with the collections and the cost of this. And this really has a benefit in a couple of reasons. One, a product stewardship group can work on economies of scale that individual, separate local units of government that can't. So that reduces the overall cost overall for folks to properly dispose of them. Number two, their outreach can also go to a wider audience in places that traditionally we may not have it, which would increase the amount of recycling or proper disposal of these products. And three, in some cases, when a manufacturer is responsible for the end-of-life process of these materials, they can design them in a way which is easier to properly dispose of, recycle later, thus saving money. And an example of that we've seen across the nation is with e-waste. Computer manufacturers have designed their systems now so they're easier to disassemble and properly recycle. When previously they weren't responsible for the disposal aspect of it, that wasn't one of their considerations when going into the design. So this initiative would have those manufacturers put together a program. They would pay for that effort to move forward to collect and set up the collection systems across the state. The part that specifically touches the MPCA is that the MPCA would have oversight role. We would review those product stewardship plans. We would look at audits to make sure they're doing what they're asked. And so there is a small cost to the state. And what we propose doing is much like for environmental review, we would, for an EIS, we would bill out those costs to those manufacturers, and they would then cover those costs. So it's not any new fees being created for the state to collect or any new money from state funds. It would be from those organizations. Currently, the paint industry supports this effort. They'll be around talking to you to support. The primary battery folks approached us and are seeking state legislation to move forward with it and are are looking at the language. And the carpet industry supported a similar mechanism in another state that we're modeling this off of. And we had a conference call with them yesterday to answer some of their questions and to work through any problems they may have on the issue.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kadelk, on that carpet thing, I'm struggling here. Do we landfill carpet or do we burn carpet?
Yep.
Do we incinerate?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, it's both. Right now, about 2.5% of the municipal solid waste stream is carpet, and it goes up when we're looking at construction and demo. It's over 3%, almost 4% is carpet. So it does take up a lot of room in our landfills, and it's pretty hard to handle. It's not something you can put on the curb, so it's very difficult for waste haulers to handle also. So there's a better way to collect it, and that's what we're looking for. And where possible, we would like to recycle it. Nylon and carpet does have markets that we could sell and put it back into.
So is this product stewardship program that you're thinking about initiating require a separate bill, or will it be?
Mr. Chair, we will. It will be in the budget bill since there is the fiscal aspect, but we've also will be introducing a separate policy bill because it does need to go to a number of committees, including environment policy, commerce, and civil law for various aspects. But it will end in your committee, end up there.
If it gets past civil law. Okay. Go ahead.
Continuing, this isn't a change item, but it was something that was mentioned earlier in your briefing, and we just want to make sure you're aware of it. The state has a closed landfill investment account to handle the long-term care of our closed landfills. Early on, the state had a number of landfills that were in the Superfund program and were creating problems. The legislature created a separate program, the closed landfill program, to handle them in a much more expedited fashion than the Superfund system allows. There are 112 landfills across the state that are eligible. 109 of them are in the system. And we are close to finishing the major construction on those that are in the system, as the commissioner mentioned. During the same time, in the early on during the development of the program, a long-term fund was made to cover the cost and liability of these facilities for the operation and maintenance and unexpected construction that would be needed. In 2010, those dollars, $48 million, was used from that fund to help with a budget deficit at that time. And in the 2010 law, it was written that it would be paid back with 12 equal payments starting in fiscal year 15 of $12 million plus interest. This, in fiscal year 15, the first of those repayments is scheduled to occur. The next area is our water program. And much like in the air program, we do have a similar request of $1.5 million from the Environmental Fund for each year to help with our water program and all that's involved. Again, some of these dollars will be going to our database system and online system to improve the customer service effort and turn our data outwards. Also, in working with our standards work, whether it's effluent limits for site-specific cases. As we're going around through our watershed monitoring assessment work, we're collecting more data. And as we know more data, we also know when we get to the borderline of when a discharge will have a potential to have a serious impact on a water. In those cases, specific standards for that discharge are needed to be created, which is a more rigorous process at the agency. And we are seeing more of those, which is requiring more staff and other expertise at the agency. Some of those dollars would be helped with that similar standard work. Again, these are from the application fees that are already being collected and deposited in the Environmental Fund. What we're asking to happen is for that money to be appropriated to us to use. The next program is our wastewater lab quality assurance and quality control program.
Let's go back now. This is a couple of spots now that you've said you want money given to you to do something else with other than what it's doing right now. What's the money doing right now that you're trying to get from the Environmental Fund?
Mr. Chair and committee members, it's sitting in the fund.
Why?
Mr. Chair and committee members, it can't be used until the legislature appropriates it to us.
Okay. Are we collecting too much in fees? Is that why, or what's going on?
Mr. Chair, in 2009, we were required by the legislature to create the application fee program, which we've done, and those fees are being collected in there and being deposited in there right now.
Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Kukalka. So the legislature required you to collect the fees but didn't allow you to use them and just required you to collect them and then deposit them? Is that what it is, or why are – I am too.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, going back at least two biennia, the direction that came out of the legislature was for the agency to take a look at the application process, both for air and water, and get to a point where what was being collected for applications covered the cost of processing the applications.
And these are, so applications for fees for what?
Primarily,
For
Mr. Chair and members, primarily for new projects or significant changes.
So for permits or?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Mr. Chair and members, the rulemaking process took quite a while, a number of years. It was finally approved, made retroactive to the beginning of fiscal 10. However, at that point in time, which was in the depths of the recession, there was enough uncertainty about the level of activity, new projects coming through, that the agency did not put forward a request to increase the amount of application fees that were coming in. So it was a deliberate effort or decision at that point to wait until that funding stream had stabilized. So over the last couple of years, the application fees have been deposited to the Environmental Fund, and right now we are carrying a fund balance in the Environmental Fund.
Go ahead, Senator Westrom, you had your hand up.
Mr. Chair, to that point, can you tell us what's the balance again? How much about?
Mr. Chair, and members, we are projecting a balance. If I can turn to the right page here, I believe an available fund balance at the end of fiscal 13 of about $9 million in the Environmental Fund, and in our various requests, both in the air program, the 1.5 in the air program and the water program, over a period of time, will significantly use up that existing fund balance.
Mr. Chair, so this is an application fee for basically any environmental permit. And about how much are we charging for permits? It's a lot of money to raise in 3-4 years.
Mr. Chair and Senator, this is an application fee. I wouldn't characterize it as any environmental project. I would, on the air side, it becomes an application for primarily a new construction project or a significant change in operations that requires a change in their permit. And similarly on the water side, these would primarily be construction or significant change in operation kind of applications. If I can back up to the example of the air applications, prior to this rulemaking process, while there was a first time fee for if you were coming into the air program for the first time, but it was a fairly low level fee, and that was discontinued as we went to this new application process. In the last two fiscal years, air applications have generated close to $800,000 per fiscal year, but again, we're anticipating that will continue to increase as the economy slowly increases, and we expect seeing an uptick in the number of applications that come through the process.
It sounds – another question, sir? No, and it sounds to me like you're your intent was to increase the fees to generate the amount of money to take care of the applications, but that you're getting way more than you need to take care of the applications. Is that what I'm hearing here? Is that why there's a fund balance that you can tap into for other programs?
Mr. Chair and members, no. There's an effort going on now to take a look at basically how well the agency did in terms of setting its pricing structure. I wouldn't expect you to remember this, but they built a pricing structure that's based on a point system that reflects the complexity of the application. And so there's a dollar amount assigned to each point, and then again, depending on the complexity of the application, then different steps throughout the application process are assigned a certain number of points. And as I said, there's an effort underway right now to kind of match up the level of fees that have been generated with the level of effort that's invested in the application process and determine if that pricing structure needs to be adjusted.
Well, it must need to be adjusted because you're trying to steal from it with these other programs. But anyway, go ahead, Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the overall amount of fee dollars that we receive is not enough to run the permitting programs that we have in the agency. Those earlier charts showed other funding and revenue sources into the agency. So if we do a dive down into the details, that is the environmental fund. A lot of different sources come in to help fund the overall agency. It is different than the DNR, where they have very specific pots of money for very specific uses. This allows for us to be able to more quickly react to various things and use a prioritization in the areas.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in general, tell me how much general fund money you have in the last biennium versus fee-based revenues. Fees versus general fund.
Mr. Chair and Senator, our appropriation from the general fund currently is a little more than $5 million. And we generate kind of on an annual basis, we generate about 23 to 25 million in fees from regulated parties.
Okay, Mr. Kudelka, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, moving on to our next one, wastewater lab. This is a program that's currently being run in the Department of Health. At one point, the drinking water and wastewater lab quality assurance programs were very similar. The needs were very similar, and so we consolidated in one effort. As the needs for the drinking water program with health has grown and become more rigorous than what we need for the wastewater labs, it really was a system that didn't quite fit what we needed and what the users needed. And so there were some concerns. What we're doing here is we're going to split the two programs apart, and the wastewater lab quality assurance will come back to the agency here, and we will... we're requesting authorization to set a fee for it that would cover the costs. As a result, the end users will have a more streamlined certification requirements because we're right-sizing the program to their needs. They were being asked to do additional things because of what drinking water was needed. And then we would also end up, this would be a net result, instead of paying the Department of Health a higher amount, they will be paying the PCA a smaller amount to get what we need. So this really is one of those right-sizing governments to respond to the needs of the users. The next item here is our Clean Water Fund initiatives. We have two slides of the various...
I'm sorry if I'm not following closely today, but so you're this is being recommended to be transferred from the Department of Health, the lab quality program. And how do they pay for it there?
Mr. Chair and committee members, they have a fee structure also. They would, the folks would no longer have to pay the Department of Health. They would go under our program, And as a result, the fees that we anticipate charging compared to what Health is charging now would be less for the user.
Because you are going to do it differently, or you're more streamlined, or what? How?
Mr. Chair, correct. We will have right-sizing the requirements. The requirements for a drinking water lab quality assurance are much more detailed than what we need for a wastewater lab, so we don't want to ask them to do the additional work when it's not needed. So it is streamlining, as you said.
Okay.
The next is a series of initiatives from the Clean Water Fund. A Clean Water Interagency team gets together and puts together its recommendations, and we focus on a couple of things. Each agency works to its expertise, and we also coordinate so we don't have any overlapping of programs. So as a result, you may see an agency spend some dollars on monitoring and another agency spend some dollars on monitoring, but we are working towards what is really our strengths. The two items I would like to focus on are the first and third bullet there. Under the previous amount of money that the agency was getting, we were getting to every watershed or lake about once every 100 years. With the Clean Water Legacy Amendment, we are now able to get to each watershed once every 10 years, which means we are able to go in, determine the conditions of the waters, determine what are the pollution sources, and devise what we are calling watershed restoration and protection strategies, RAPs, so that we can have a plan moving forward on how to get impaired waters back to the healthy state and protect those waters that are in that state and prevent them from going to be impaired. That data is then used by other partners on non-point sources, local units of government, so that they know where to target their resources for on-the-ground activities. And it's used by our regulatory programs at the PCA for wastewater and stormwater, so we know also where to target to get the reductions we need to protect our waters and restore them. On the next page, there are two I would like to highlight. It's the second and third bullets. These are, as mentioned, the agency and all of our agencies, as we collect this data, we have a large amount of information which really needs to be shared with others. We need to turn that information out. The first one there, the Watershed Research Database, is an effort that the agency has started and received money previously from the Clean Water Fund. And we are towards the tail end of it, of collecting all that information and making it available on our websites so anyone can access it, whether it's a local unit of government, an interested individual, or a regulated party that's looking, well, maybe do I want to locate there? They have the data so they know when they're going in for the permitting process or any other process what to expect. That third bullet there, the interagency data portal, is so we all have our data. What we want to do is now bring that to one-stop shop of all the information. So you can get DNRs, health, AGs, any local units of government, and anyone else that has water quality data by going to one site instead of each of our individual websites. And so this money would start the process of behind-the-scenes work of getting that data in the proper format so that we can create the online system. Our next area is environmental assistance and cross-media program. And the first item here is the EQB. The EQB is a separate entity. However, its staff is located within the MPCA building, and funding does come to the agency to cover the cost. Currently, the agent from the general fund, EQB, receives $302,000 for its current functions. We are proposing to increase that from a mixture of general fund and environmental fund dollars to $500,000 per year. In response to a governor's resolution, the EQB did do a study and passed the resolution on where to focus its work in the coming years. And there were three areas. One is cross-agency coordination, so those issues that are larger than any one agency, we can come together and make sure that we handle them in an appropriate way. Some of those areas, for instance, right now, EQB is looking at the issue of frac sand and making sure that we're all on the same page, the agencies, that we are not duplicating efforts or going crosswise with each other, telling one person one thing or someone else the other. So that work is very important to create a streamlined policy by the state and any other needs. It also provides an opportunity for public participation. Individuals can then approach all the agencies at once to discuss these complex problems.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, you touched on frac sanding. That is the new thing now that hopefully folks are going to be coming forward with to make it clear as to what hazards that mining really produces. During the process, have you learned when mining that sand, dampening it down or mining it in a more wet form or fashion? Maybe this is a premature question, but has any of that been talked about at all?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's a good question. Those are the things that EQB is working on. We're looking at all the agency's information. Moisture content during the transportation of the sand does help with some issues, and so that's one of the areas that's being looked at. I know there will be hearings, I believe, in the Senate Policy Committee upcoming scheduled on the issue, where the agencies will come in and also talk about our efforts on the EQB level and what each of our individual agencies' roles are in the issue.
Kirk, is the $500,000, is that the total ask, or is that an increase above the $302,000?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. That is the total ask.
Okay, and then are you increasing FTEs at the EQB, or?
Mr. Chair and committee members, currently EQB has two staff members. This would allow for the EQB to go to five staff members to carry out those three items identified in the resolution. The second item is working on environmental review. EQB really is the oversight and sets the policy for environmental review. They also are a very helpful assistance device. Right now, the bulk of environmental review is not done by state agencies, rather local units of government. And many times, they may only do environmental review on a certain project once every 10 years, or it may be the first time they ever do it. And so the EQB acts as a resource for local units of government. They receive over 1,000 calls each year from local units of government and others asking about how to do this. So this would be us as a state providing resources to the local unit of government for them to handle their environmental review, so they don't have to add additional capacity. The third item in the resolution is creating a portal for environmental review. Again, if we can get all the information on environmental review out there, and a county decides that this is the first time they have to do an environmental review for, say, a gravel pit, and they haven't done one before, they could access the system and look and see what other counties have done, so they don't have to recreate the wheel. It would streamline and reduce the amount of work they have to do. They could see the concerns that other constituents have brought in other areas, and they can take those on beforehand. And the hope would be a better product that has better information in environmental review and one that's done in a quicker turnaround fashion so that the regulated parties or those proposers could get their work done if it meets the proper protections. Mr. Chair, just to break down that $500,000 number that we talked about, under this proposal, each year $312,000 of that would be
for Senator Herc. You have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, in regard to the increased opportunity for public participation, would you be able to elaborate or, you know, tell us what's the approach the agency approach will be?
Mr. Chair and Senator, an example, we can go back to the issue of frac sand. As the agencies were trying to create their policy and how they will handle the situation, there were a number of hearings that were had. So frac sand companies came in and talked to the agencies, providing them with their opinion, what they're doing, and collecting information. At the same time, individual members of the public were able to come in and talk about their concerns and their wishes and what they would like to see done. So it's an ability for one person to touch many agencies, because in that room is the Department of Health, ourselves, the DNR, Department of Transportation, and others. So those are the opportunities for the public to engage on those larger issues with the state setting policy on.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just to give you a further breakdown of that $500,000 per year, $312,000 of it would be from the general fund, and then $188,000 of it would be from the environmental fund. The next proposal is an environmental health risk proposal. This is a joint proposal with the Department of Health. As the commissioner mentioned, the environment plays about a 20% role in public health. And so what we would like to do with this dollars are focus on two areas to help connect the dots between environmental exposure and health questions. And the two areas we'd like to focus on is, number one, is mercury across the state. Number two, we would like to look at chronic respiratory disease, especially in metropolitan areas. And so those are the here you'll see $600,000 used from the environmental fund that would be split between the agency and the Department of Health. As you can see there, 5/6 of that would go to the Department of Health to work on efforts to create a better understanding of projects and how it affects at-risk populations, but also then educate information so that when project proposers move forward, we can put in preventive methods into the system when we're looking at air pollution in the metropolitan area so public health is protected, and that we would lean upon the risk analysis expertise in MPCA, but also the larger public health experience of the Department of Health. The next item is a sanitary district formation.
Yeah, go back to that
yeah.
previous slide. Did you say the $499,000 is a transfer from the $600,000?
Mr. Chair, correct.
Okay.
The next item is our sanitary district formation. Currently, this item resides within the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and we are given the authority to help with the creation of sanitary districts or any disbanding of them. We really think that we are not the best folks to handle this. The Office of Administrative Hearings, their Municipal Boundary Adjustment Unit, administers state uniform systems for boundary adjustments, and we really think they are the better ones to handle this than us, because what we're dealing with here is more the administrative side than the environmental and health protection side. When we look at an unsewered community and we find out there may be direct discharges to a body of water, MPCA will work with the local community and the county on devising options on how they can prevent that, whether it's upgrading their individual septic systems or they move to a community system of some sort. That's the right spot for the MPCA to be involved. If they decide to move forward with a wastewater treatment facility or something else where they would need to create a sanitary district and an organization to run that, helping them set that logistics up of that group really does fall better within the Office of Administrative Hearings. They have the expertise in that area to go through the paperwork. So what we would do is propose transferring this function over to the Office of Administrative Hearings. They would set up a rules and fees to help cover those costs, just like they do for annexation issues and any other issue, and that would come to the environmental fund, those fees, and then be appropriated and sent to the Office of Administrative Hearings to cover their costs. As a result of it, we would simplify the effort, and also because they are experts in it, they could do it for a lower cost than we are doing now.
Are we going to make it more confusing, though?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we hope to make it easier. Folks who do this type of work on other types of city boundaries work with the Office of Administrative Hearing. Right now, if they come to us, it's probably more confusing than working with us when we may only do these once a year, and we don't have the expertise that they do at the Office of Administrative Hearing.
And so is this $75,000 and $50,000, is that fee generated?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the Office of Administrative Hearings would cover set a fee to cover the cost. It would go into the environmental fund and be appropriated out, transferred to them. Currently, right now, those funds are just being covered by the environmental fund as is.
So this would be a new fee then?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this would be a new fee, but similar to the ones that the Office of Administrative Hearings levies for similar actions. So this would fit within their broader program and fee-based structure over at the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how much revenue are they showing now in that area, the administrative hearing? How much is being brought in now?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, currently there are none. And the meeting costs in that are things that a hearing in this effort, there are some cost recovery for hearings, but all the other work, there is no system. That is something the agency covers.
So just to follow up, Mr. Chair, and thank you. So how much are you planning on saving here by shifting this? What does the department think you're saving? How much? Net.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, it's about $25,000.
And you're sure it's not going to make it more confusing?
Mr. Chair, our hope is to make it less confusing. This area of law is something that we're not familiar with, and in some regards, it's confusing to us.
Senator Rood? No, okay. We all are, okay. I think they tried to do that on purpose. Okay, is that the end of your presentation?
Mr. Chair, we are done.
Did we cover, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yeah, just thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kudelka, for that report, and I'm sorry I was late. If you went over this document, it says the fees here, and I'm noticing the total agency fees on regulated parties on that line, noticing that from year 2011 to 12, there was a reduction. Is that any indication in your mind or the department's mind of a lack of new business or new business expansion, so we're still kind of sitting in that coming out of recession, if you will, and not coming out very fast, mean there's a reduction in fees here?
Mr. Chair and Senator, actually, I think what it reflects is as you go kind of line item by line item, and let's use feedlots as an example. Feedlot is a subset of the water quality fees. You'll see that in fiscal 11, there's actually a significant step up, which reflects that's a permit area or category where there's not only an annual permit fee, but also a permit that's either on a 3 or 5 year, and I'll misspeak whichever way I answer that, 5 year cycle. And so you see that in 11, you know, the fees take a step up. That appears to also be the case with wastewater, that there's also kind of a not just the annual fee, but also an additional cyclical fee.
So Mr. Chair, just a quick follow up. So you don't see that. It's a rather confusing answer, I guess. You don't know whether it's 3 or 5 year fee permits the feedlots are required to pay. So I was just noticing the numbers is all. I was just wondering as to why. But there would be a jump in fees, which you're saying in 11. That would have no reflection whatsoever of the year 2012 when it comes to business expansion or new businesses then. I mean, I'm under the impression that we're starting to come back, and so that's not a reflection.
Mr. Chair and Senator, We would agree that while we're not seeing new applications absolutely take off, we are seeing a slow and steady increase in fees basically across the board, and we assume that reflects just the growing strength of the economy.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Mueller. I apologize. I had to step out if you've already addressed this. But the question I had was, have you discussed in your presentation the fines that the department is collecting and where those dollars are being utilized?
I think we heard anything about fines, or did we? Did we hear fines? No, we didn't hear fines, did we?
Mr. Chair and Senator, again on that same page, but rather going back to the pie chart of receipts to the environmental fund, we called out, and it's not a large slice of the overall receipts to the fund, but of the total $179 million, $3.9 million is generated in not. We don't use the word fines, but rather penalties.
Sanctions.
And so when we estimate penalties over a period of time, for example, we're using a five-year average. So we're really looking backwards and letting that help us arrive at our estimate into the future. So currently our estimate for penalties in each of the next two fiscal years is $1.9 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you just rolling that into your general pie chart of money? You don't have any dedicated use for those? Or
Mr. Chair and Senator, 100% of the penalties go into the environmental fund. And yes, they go in as non-dedicated receipts, which mean that they are not specifically used to drive the enforcement effort within the agency. Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I apologize. I stepped out for a minute, so we might have discussed this. Two quick questions.
You're going to stop admitting you weren't here, okay?
So, and some of this is just trying to track what you were saying with the budget book we have here, and it's a little confusing, but how many employees are there in the PCA about?
Mr. Chair, Senator, currently for fiscal 13, we're using 968 FTE. Now, where that can become a little confusing is that you have to remember that state government created a new agency called MINIT for IT, and if you take those and for us that's 68 employees. So as we move ahead into fiscal 14 and 15, you'll see our FTE estimate take a step down equal to that number of IT employees.
Thank you. I have another question. You, Mr. Kudalka, briefly mentioned the old, I think you said in here somewhere, it's 17-year-old legacy computer system, and you mentioned upgrading that, and I didn't see costs for this, again, in this book. And so do you have any estimates of how much that's going to cost, and is it going to be like over a few years fix, or are you going to try to do it in one bite, and then again, where the money is coming from?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that is something that we are still negotiating the final contract with the vendor, so we don't have an exact dollar amount, and that depending on how those negotiations go, that may be just behind-the-scenes stuff or all the stuff you'll see on the web, all the add-ons. So we do not have an exact dollar amount. We anticipate this will be a four-year effort. We have put away some dollars already.
$3 to $4 million?
$3.5 million already that we've been squirreling away because we knew we would have to do this project. And some of the funds on the $1.5 million appropriations for air and water will help cover some of those additional costs beyond that, because we will need to pull folks from the permitting program over, and we want to backfill them so we don't have a downturn on timeliness of permits as a result.
Okay, how are we doing on getting bills written up?
Mr. Chair and committee members, my understanding is they are being finalized right now. We've just got an email on them to one last check.
I like your little iPhone there or something. You just got an email? Or?
Well, today. I apologize on the time.
Oh, okay, all right. Okay, any further questions? All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is the zoo still here? This is good, staff. We have two presentations in a row where the technology is working. This is okay. Go ahead. Say your name for the record, and then go ahead and
Mr. Chair, members
tell us
of the
why there's no animals.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lee Emke. I'm the director and CEO of the Minnesota Zoo. And I do want to apologize that we don't have animals here. We had planned on it, but we're working out some communication issues about rules for the state capitol and what's allowed in and what's not allowed in. We hope to have that all resolved before our Zoo Day at the Capitol, which has been traditionally held in March, and we're looking forward to that on March 21st. So we hope to have animals then, and we'll make sure you get an invitation to see that.
So have we had animals in committee before?
Yeah. Yes, many times. And one of the reasons, actually, we've had it in, for many years, so this was a rule that just sort of came up that we weren't aware of. The reason we like to bring animals, not only to break up the sort of mid-afternoon blahs in a committee, but it really allows us to illustrate tangibly our mission, which is connecting people, animals, and the natural world. And our point of difference, what makes a zoo, a zoological institution, different from any other science-based institution or go from Animal Planet on down, is the presence of living animals. That's what makes the experience of the zoo unique and we think pretty meaningful, whether it's at the zoo or whether it's in a committee hearing or as part of our outreach education program.
So did you let the animals walk down the table like Letterman and, you know?
There have been some pretty interesting opportunities to get up close and personal with armadillos and a few other critters on this very table.
On this very table.
Hope to provide that in the future.
So what happened? Did somebody read the rules, or what happened here?
Exactly. Apparently, and unbeknownst to us, there is a rule that any animal that's to come into the state capitol needs prior approval by the commissioner of the Department of Administration. The commissioner was unaware of the rule himself and was looking to form guidelines for exempting or creating exemptions to that rule.
So there must be some new person there that's doing this. Is that?
I think that might be correct. Thank you.
So how did we get seated at the table?
Mr. Chair, that is also correct.
That is also correct. All right, go ahead.
Okay. The Minnesota Zoo, as I mentioned, our mission is to connect people, animals, and the natural world. We do that in three interconnected ways at the zoo. We have conservation programs, which I'll talk about a bit. We provide environmental education. And all of that comes kind of wrapped up in a package of recreation. People attend the zoo to have fun with their families, but in the meantime, that's really connected to our conservation and education missions. And for those of you who visited the zoo, you realize that the three of them are not really separable. It all kind of works together as a holistic whole. We are fairly unique as a state agency. We were established in law in the 1970s specifically to be a public-private partnership. We were authorized from the get-go to contract for services at the zoo to provide revenue influxes. We were also authorized from the beginning to work with our foundation, our 501c3 support group, to raise private funds to support the operation and capital development of the zoo. And as a result, I think we've formed a pretty unique partnership, public-private partnership, that in many ways I think is a model for state government and for institutions like ourselves. The contributions in recent years have really increased despite the economy. A lot of that has been based on the fact that the state has invested in its asset, in its facility, and the private sector has responded in kind. This slide just gives you a sampling of many of the Minnesota companies that are involved in the zoo and providing either capital support or ongoing programmatic support for our efforts. And as a result, we've been able to grow our programs, grow our facilities, and reach more people and do more conservation work, again, as part of this public-private partnership. This slide, I think, also reflects the evolution of the funding history of the zoo. We are a state agency, and back in the 1980s, we relied largely on the biennial appropriation for our operations. You can see that in 1985, 60% of our operating budget came from the appropriation that comes through this committee. Over time, obviously, our costs have increased, but the proportion of our funding has also changed pretty dramatically. And currently, 29% of our total operating budget comes from state sources. It's a combination of the general fund appropriation and legacy funding. But the majority of our funding is now either self-generated through our operations or comes to the zoo in the form of contributions through the foundation. So 71%...
Senator Scoia has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could you give us what the 60% and the 29% are in actual dollars?
I'd ask Mary Robinson, our CFO, to provide that number. I think
Going to the next slide.
Ms. Robinson, would you just say your name for the record, please?
Sorry, Mary Robinson, the CFO for the Minnesota Zoo. Do you want to take this?
Sure. If you can read, Mr. Chair, Senator, you can read the pie chart here. The state appropriation in the last fiscal year was $5.5 million. The legacy appropriation was $1.5 million, and the remainder was either earned, 63% of the remainder was earned revenue, and then 8% contributed income. So, again, going back to this slide, you can see that the proportion has essentially reversed itself from where we were 20 years ago to the present.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoia.
And I don't know, you don't know this. Do you know what the state appropriation was in 1985, the 60% number? I mean, I'm trying to get a feel for what the change is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoia, I don't have that number at hand, but certainly the overall cost of operating the zoo has increased significantly over time. So this is a proportional relationship. I know that in recent years, the state appropriation has declined from a high point, I believe in 06, of about $8 million a year to its current level.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoia, just in general, if you look over the past 10, 15 years, the appropriation has gone up and down over time, fluctuating from, say, $8 million a year to about $5 million. So, as a dollar amount, it remains. There's been some fluctuation, but it's remained relatively consistent. With the exception of the past biennium, where we saw a significant decrease 2 years ago. But our operations overall has been increasing, and that's part of what you're seeing.
Thank you.
Okay.
And related, obviously, to where the money's coming from is where it goes, how we expend the money. And we have quite high fixed costs at the zoo. As you can imagine, it's a 365-day, 24-hour operation with life support, and thousands of animals that are relying on our keeping their environment healthy and safe, and trained staff to care for the animals, as well as our education programs and the like. So you can see here the breakdown of where the funding goes. And again, the state appropriation is used primarily to fund the salaries of our animal care and operations staff. So that is really the baseline for our operations. Our earned revenues and contributed revenues tend to go towards the conservation programming or education programming and kind of the new and different things that we like to add value to our facility with. This year, the governor's recommendation is to hold our appropriation at the same level that it was in the last 2 years, in the last biennium. And again, that's about $5.425 million of general fund money, about $160,000 of lottery in lieu or natural resources fund money, which we've been receiving pretty consistently over the years. So a total appropriation for the biennium, a little over $11 million.
When you said consistently, do you mean it was always $160,000, or you've just been consistently getting it? Has the number been the same over the years that you've gotten from the Natural Resources Fund?
Mr. Chair, the number's been relatively consistent. It's gone up a little bit, but it's been in the range of a little over $100,000 since I've been director for the last 12 years. Clearly, the operation of the zoo costs continue to rise with a large contingent of staff. We're looking at contract costs that will be increasing next year and in the future. Utility costs are obviously a major factor for us. So we're seeing the likelihood of our overall budget increasing in the upcoming biennium. But given the state situation, obviously, if we can maintain the current baseline level of support through the general fund appropriation, we would be quite pleased with that result. In formulating our budget proposal, we looked to the governor's statewide outcomes that were kind of looking at, you know, what's the value of state government and the investment in state government. And one of them is clearly to create a thriving economy for the state. And I think, as you've seen, this is a photo of the concert series that's held at the zoo every year. We do a number of things that generate revenue, not just for the zoo, but that have a pretty significant impact statewide. We just commissioned an economic impact study, which is actually in your packets, and it shows that over the course of a year, of the last year, we generate indirectly and directly $146 million of benefit for the state of Minnesota. Again, based on, when you think about it, a $5.5 million appropriation, we think that's a pretty good return on investment. That impact is based largely on attendance and the number of people who are visiting the zoo and are therefore bringing money into the economy through transportation, tourism, and the like. And we've seen a very significant increase, a steady increase in our attendance over the last few years. Our last fiscal year, we had the highest attendance in the history of the zoo, nearly 1.4 million people, our all-time high in 35 years. And I would again say that that result has become possible because of the investment by the state of Minnesota through capital investment in new facilities at the zoo, which has in turn spurred investment by private companies and individual donors that have allowed us to build great new exhibits, which have attracted record numbers of guests to the zoo.
Oh, is that one? Do you have a breakdown of where they come from, the people who visit the zoo?
Mr. Chair, yes. We have we take zip codes of most of the guests who come into the zoo, and we have approximately 20% of our total visitation comes from outside the 7-county metro, so that includes greater Minnesota and, to some extent, neighboring states and a small but increasing number of tourists to the state.
All in the 20%. All of the neighboring states and outside of Minnesota. That's what I was wondering there. So but that particular number is not big coming from the tourism sector. In other words,
Mr. Chair, it's not a huge number. We think it is growing, and I think relative to other zoos around the country, zoos tend to be regional attractions. Only a few, I think, you know, the San Diego Zoo and a couple of others are truly tourism destinations.
You must have a kiosk at the Mall of America.
We would love to have a kiosk there. I think the mall would like to keep people at the mall. and we are, as we've said, only 10 minutes away from the mall, so I think we do get a fair number of people who visit both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Amke, we were discussing the other day what did you say, the Minnesota Zoo is in the top, how many in the country? And
Mr. Chair and Senator, as I've noted at these hearings before, there is no formal rating agency for zoos, so it's a little hard to come up with a U.S. World and News Report kind of rating of zoos.
Yeah, I understand.
That said, there are unofficial polls that are out there, and certainly within the industry, we are viewed as one of the top 10 zoos in the country, which was a goal that we set out several years ago as we were starting on our master plan development. And in terms of all the metrics, whether it's attendance, our education and conservation programming, our exhibits, and to some extent even our overall budget, we do rank within the top tier of the nation's zoos.
And just as a follow-up, because we're so far north, would our zoo have some exhibits that, as far as the United States goes, that would some other zoos might not have? I mean, I realize the Winnipeg Zoo might have.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yeah, I think we've had a focus on northern climate animals, which makes sense for where we are and our part of the world and the terrain that we have. But we've developed, especially in recent years, a number of really unique exhibits, one of which is the Minnesota Trail, as the Minnesota State Zoo, to have an exhibit that really focuses on native wildlife in a very comprehensive way is certainly unique. And our Russia's Grizzly Coast exhibit that opened in 2008, which has won national awards for design, focuses on the Russian Far East and the wildlife from that part of the world, which, as far as I know, is unique in the world and has really put us on the map in terms of zoo exhibitry globally.
Senator Saxok, now that I have half of Itasca County, I'm very concerned that there's no zoo outreach to Itasca County, so we may have to work on that. But
Mr. Chair, it's because there's already so many animals up there.
He's not wrong. I was driving from Big Fork to Nashwauk. I counted 55 deer one day, so maybe you don't have to come up there.
Mr. Chair, just to continue to talk about the economic impact of the zoo, we are continuing to look at growth. We've just completed the largest capital effort in our history, about a $76 million campaign that developed the new exhibits that I just mentioned. But we've just completed a new master plan that we're looking at the next 10 to 15 years of growth to take advantage of the beautiful site that we have at the zoo and some of the opportunities to really create a world-class facility. And clearly, and actually you'll see in the economic impact study that the impact of new construction at the zoo is not even included in that $146 million figure that I gave you. Additional construction that we hope to embark on will add, obviously, jobs and other economic benefit to the community. A second statewide outcome that we think we are serving very well is to sustain and create a clean and healthy environment. As an environmental organization, as a space that focuses on exhibiting animals and understanding the connections between them and the environment, the zoo is very engaged in that activity. And we're doing it at a number of different levels. We are a global conservation organization. We have staff, and we provided funding through our nonprofit support organization to many projects around the world aimed at protecting animals and protecting their habitats. We participate in 60 species survival plans. Those are the breeding programs for rare species at zoos nationally and internationally. And we've participated in a number of international conservation programs, including a couple that have received significant notoriety recently, including our black rhino conservation efforts in Namibia. So, again, our reputation within the zoo and conservation community has always been as a leader, and with the recent success of the zoo, we've been able to expand those programs. But more and more in the last few years, we've been focusing on Minnesota-based conservation. As the Minnesota Zoo, we think it's our obligation, and it's obviously there are critical needs that we think we can help address. With legacy funding, we're now engaged in a breeding program for endangered prairie butterflies and working with partners around the state on issues of habitat protection, prairie restoration, and, again, focusing on some of the critical butterfly species that we're losing at a pretty rapid rate. And connected to that, at the zoo, we are creating, on a very small scale, some prairie restoration projects that will allow us to engage our many, our millions of guests with the whole notion of the importance of prairies that have essentially vanished from the state, as well as to engage them with the conservation of breeding programs of the butterflies that depend on the prairie environment. We've been engaged most recently. We're very excited about a project that we're working on with the DNR to bring in purebred American bison from a number of sources around the country, breed them at the zoo in a new facility we've constructed, and eventually work with the DNR to have small herds of these animals released into state parks where they formerly ranged, historically ranged throughout Minnesota. And I think this is the kind of partnership that we know is critical for conservation. You can't do it on your own, no one institution, no one agency. And it's been great to be able to partner with the DNR on this really important and pretty high visibility project.
How heavy are they? How heavy are those bison?
Mr. Chair, I did not bring my zoology experts here, so I would hazard a guess that we're...
Senator Weber knows.
Well, being the home of the Blue Mountain State Park, Mr. Chairman, with a DNR bison herd there, they have ton bulls, and we actually had for quite a while a private rancher who had a bison herd that we actually gave tours on, so it was always sort of fun to have people out there and actually have pellets there that they would have, they have a ton about that long they would come out and get. And those bulls reach a ton, and we would, if you ask a person who works with them and you ask them herd a buffalo, you just herd him anywhere he wants to go. So
to that point, who weighs them?
They actually have a scale there because they have an annual sale there every year.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
And then what was the number of bison or buffaloes that we used to have roaming the plains of Minnesota?
I didn't study that chapter. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
That wasn't part of the tour. Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair, can I ask Senator Weber a quick question?
Uh-huh.
How do you keep the bison in the state park?
They have quite an extensive fence system there. And now, Mr. Chairman and Senator Sparks, if they were ever to really get scared, I don't know if there's a fence system that would actually keep them in. But so far, they haven't had any issues.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I'd like to kind of add to that. We've been working with the staff at Blue Mound State Park. They've been great partners in this project. And one of the things we've looked at and compared notes on are exactly the questions you brought up about what actually will contain bison, how do you weigh them. Every year, our veterinary staff works with the Blue Mound staff to do a genetic testing kind of a health analysis. So, and to the question of the former numbers of bison, at one time, bison ranged over the entire Midwest in numbers that were greater than any other large mammal on Earth. It was, you'll hear about the vast herds that you see the photos of the Serengeti Plains in Africa. Those are what you see there is almost dwarfed by what used to be the herds of bison here in the U.S., including southwestern Minnesota. So we're never going to get back to that state, but I think the opportunity to restore bison to their historic range is something that we're very excited about. Another conservation program
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I looked at the slide behind, and more of a problem to worry about, of course, is the moose. Most recently, the DNR has made a decision, and I think a good one, to postpone the moose season because of the declining numbers. I see you've got data underway. How active are you in this research with the moose decline research that's going on?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we've been quite engaged for the last several years. Our veterinary staff and now conservation biology staff are partnering with the DNR and the University of Minnesota research team that have been doing the work that's been so much in the news recently. We're specifically helping out by providing veterinary assistance, so when the animals are being tranquilized and fitted for radio collars and the like, our staff are working hand-in-hand with the DNR staff on that project. We also have a conservation biologist who's doing comparative studies of habitat selection by moose at our zoo, trying to figure out what are the microhabitats that they seek out, especially during the hot summer months, and at the same time doing research on wild moose to get a sense of where are they taking refuge during the hot summer months, which clearly is one of the variables that seems to be impacting their population. So we've been engaged at a significant level, but again, with legacy funding in the past year, we've been able to increase our involvement, and we certainly hope to have some good science to back up a lot of the conjecture about what's going on with the moose, great icon of the state.
Thank you for that. And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, if I might, in your equation with the mortality rate of moose, has there been any studies done on the effects of the gray wolf or the black bear? Reason I ask that is, in my dealings with sportsmen over the years, very, I think, prominent prominent but very active, and been for years doing some trapping, and that's where I learned that the black bear will actually follow a moose around that is about ready to calf, actually follow and kill the new calf, and of course if the cow is having trouble, they will actually kill that too. Is there any studies on that you're familiar with,
Mr. Chair and Senator? That's actually part of the study that we're conducting right now. And one of the methods is to actually get a radio transmitter that provides real-time information on the location of the moose, so that researchers, when that stops moving, when they know the moose has died, they can be there quickly to really get a sense of, is there predation involved? Is it scavenging that's happening? So, again, it's an unanswered question. Certainly, predation by large predators is a variable that's out there, but how much that's influenced the population decline is unclear. We hope that the studies that we're involved in right now will help clarify that.
Thank you.
Okay. A third major statewide outcome that we're all concerned about clearly is providing skills for future workforce and increasing educational opportunities in the state. And the zoo, from the beginning, has been a primary environmental education center for the state of Minnesota. More than 350,000 participants in our programs, either at the zoo or the many outreach programs that we offer. So by the numbers, we believe we're the largest environmental education center in the state. And we do that in ways that do go beyond the school groups and general guests who visit the zoo. We have a Zoomobile program. There's a map in your packet that shows where it seems like people focus on the areas we've missed with Zoomobile, but we do try to cover most of the state in a two-year cycle, bringing animals and educators to schools, to hospitals, to libraries, and the like, and to provide a connection with living animals to residents throughout the state. In recent years, we've started to pilot, and we're now growing a program of distance learning using the internet to have live footage and live education activities at the zoo essentially beamed into schools around the state and, in fact, around the country. We're seeing this as a real growth opportunity with the technology increasing so that we can really bring our zoo and our environmental messages out to a much larger group of people who might not be able to attend the zoo. Again, these are the maps that are in your package that show where our Zoomobile program has traveled in the last couple of years, where we do have school groups who do visit us, and that it really does cover much of the state. And we also have members of our zoo in just about every county in the state of Minnesota. So although, 75% to 80% of our guests do come from the 7-county metro, we're a pretty significant attraction and education source for greater Minnesota as well. You've certainly heard a lot in recent years about STEM education, about the decline of science knowledge and skills in American schools. And we think the zoo, we've been doing STEM education from the beginning, long before the acronym was coined. And I think a lot of the way we do it is by providing a gateway to science. There's probably nothing that's going to inspire kids' interest in the natural world and the sciences than living animals. And we have programs at the zoo that are focused on improving science, technology, engineering, and math skills. Working with school districts to make sure that what we're providing at the zoo connects with the curriculum in schools. And, again, an area that we've been able to grow with a lot of private support from companies like 3M in recent years. We also spend a lot of time focusing on teachers. We do a lot of teacher training at the zoo so they can take some of the messages and the skills out to their school districts as well. We do a lot of special events at the zoo that relate not just to biology, science, and technology, but to other learning areas. I left the zoo today, and there were about 24 buses parked outside that had just unloaded Spanish students from high schools all over the state who have come to the zoo to learn their foreign language using the zoo as a tool to create interest. So older level Spanish students are setting up exhibits and providing interpretation to younger Spanish students in that language, and we do that with a number of languages each year. And we may want be one of the few opportunities for a math teacher to have a field trip that has some meaning as well. We have a zoo camp program that's been one of our most successful. It's primarily run in the summer, but it provides a very intensive opportunity for kids from preschool through high school to get engaged in the zoo in a very significant way.
These kids come down as school classes and bus loads, I assume. And how much do you charge them?
Mr. Chair, we have a greatly reduced admission fee. It's now $5 per student for school attendees. There was actually a time when we were able to provide that for no cost, but after some significant budget cuts back in 2002, we initiated this fee. That said, we've found many of our private supporters, many of the corporations that support the zoo, are now actually underwriting the entire cost of a school field trip for entire age groups and classes, so that the cost of transportation to the zoo, which has been one of the big impediments, is the fees for buses. That's covered, the admission fee to the zoo, an education program at the zoo, and in some cases even lunch is entirely underwritten by some of our major donors. And as a result, in a time when school field trips have really decreased in general because of the costs, we've seen growth in school attendance at the zoo over the last several years.
Can we get a committee bus funded for a trip to the zoo? Or?
$5, Mr.
Chairman.
$5.
Chairman normally covers the cost.
Chairman, okay.
Power.
Don't answer that yet, okay?
Look into that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the tax committee, I'm sorry.
That one doesn't want to stay with us, but let's see if it. Yeah, guess not. Creating an environment for strong and stable families is yet another major state initiative put forward by the governor, and I think the zoo has clearly served that role from the beginning. And that's evidenced by the growth in our membership. We now have more than 44,000 households that are members of the zoo, so these are people who visit on a very regular basis and take advantage of our educational program opportunities and really use the zoo in a lot of different ways. That represents nearly 200,000 individuals, and again, that is an all-time high for the zoo at 44,000 plus. Our programs are infinitely improved by the fact that we have over 1,000 adult volunteers who go through rigorous training and really serve as ambassadors to our guests at the zoo, and we couldn't do what we do without them. We talked about the classes that we offer to the general public as well as to school groups. And then just the daily guest experience, whether people know it or not, they're getting an educational opportunity when they come to the zoo through our bird show, a number of close encounter programs with animals on the trails, and the like. And I just wanted to conclude by saying I hope that you're all aware of the fact that the Minnesota Zoo has really seen a lot of success in recent years. It is recognized within the zoo and conservation community as one of the leading zoos in the world, and that's evidenced in a number of ways. We've received a number of design awards for the new exhibits at the zoo from national and international sources. Our education programs and conservation programs have also received significant achievement awards from the National Science Foundation and others. And many of the zoo's leaders are engaged in both national and international leadership in the conservation and zoo community. So I hope it's an institution that you all can take some pride in. We believe we're one of the great assets of the state. We really appreciate the support that we've received from the legislature in recent years in particular, and we look forward to continuing to be a great asset for Minnesota.
Mr. Emke, you said earlier that there's thousands of animals at the zoo. Do you know how many thousands there are?
Mr. Chair, the last count, and this changes on an hourly basis, but it's a little over 5,000, with close to 450 species being represented.
And so how long does it take somebody to go through the zoo when they go for a visit if they're just kind of walking through? And
Mr. Chair, our average stay time at the zoo is about 3.5 hours, but if you really want to see the whole thing, you'll probably need all day. We are a destination zoo with 485 acres and dozens of exhibits, and things like the family farm, which is sort of on the north end of the zoo, many people make a full day of it.
Okay. Any questions of the witnesses? Mr. Robinson, do you have anything to add?
No, sir.
Senator Westrom.
Chair, I think I know the answer to the question, but I'm going to ask it just to get any more insight. You're open year-round, I assume, and winter exhibits, what changes from them to summer, or is it just snow in the background?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we are open all but 2 days a year, so the winter is actually one of the best times to come to the zoo because it's a little less crowded. And most of our outdoor exhibits currently are of northern climate animals, so they're year-round exhibits. And in many cases, for instance, our Amur tigers and the brown bears are more active during the winter months than they are in the summer because they're comfortable in their fur coats. We offer a very large indoor experience at the zoo, our indoor aquarium facility, Discovery Bay, the Tropics Trail, our new penguin exhibit are all connected together in a single building complex. So you can actually come to the zoo and see, have a pretty significant experience and not even have to be outdoors if it's too cold. But I would also highly recommend on a nice brisk winter day, a walk through the Northern Trail is a unique experience at our zoo that is pretty magical.
Senator Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to get come. Is the IMAX Theater at the zoo part of the zoo management?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the IMAX Theater at the zoo is located on zoo property, but it's actually operated by the IMAX company. So we do a little bit of partnership in terms of marketing and the like, but it's actually a separate entity.
Okay, thank you. Just want to give some information.
Sure. And Lee, Senator Bach's better half wanted me to ask you if any animals have ever escaped from the zoo.
Mr. Chair, there have been a number of animals over time. Unfortunately, the most recent one is probably, that you remember, was a Mexican wolf that escaped at the zoo a few years ago.
Yeah.
We take great care to prevent that from happening. We have operational procedures in place for when it does happen to assure the safety of the public. But our first priority is public safety, and we design our exhibits accordingly. That said, there's no accounting for the ingenuity or of some animals and human error. So it has happened on occasion, but very, very infrequently.
Mr. Chair, actually, when I was there for one of their tours, they actually had inbound animals, wild turkeys, a variety of other non-zoo residents that decided to make themselves a home
and
migrate inbound as opposed to outbound.
Are you charging rent for that? Some kind of revenue of some kind?
Mr. Chair and Senators, I wish we could charge those turkeys.
Mr. Chair, those turkeys are pretty much the only animals I see every day, or most every day, in the back of the zoo.
And they're not yours?
They're not mine, but they do come up to the windows.
Do we make money on them around Thanksgiving?
I wish. They have changed my relationship with Thanksgiving.
Mr. Chair, just to add to that, and on a slightly more serious note, we have 485 acres. Only about half of that is developed, and the undeveloped portions of the zoo are a natural habitat for many species, including a number of endangered species. And one of the programs that, again, with legacy funds, we're hoping to start up is getting people out there to actually survey the natural inhabitants of our site and to do habitat restoration. We've got, I believe, 2% of the remaining old-growth woodland in the state of Minnesota is on zoo grounds, and we see that as an obligation to protect that habitat and interpret it to our guests as well.
So animals escaping is a relative thing then, huh?
Mr. Chair, I think that's true. We've had as many deer come into the zoo over our fence as have ever left.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, what is the urban coyote problem? Is that a problem for you?
They're really
moving this direction.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have had a coyote on site in the past. It's no longer there, so it's not a problem now. But we have a group of captive coyotes as part of our Minnesota trail who put up a group howl every night, and I'm hoping that's keeping away some of the invading coyotes.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Okay. And you have a bill coming? You must have a bill coming forward somewhere, too, huh? Mm. Or is that a part of something else?
General fund appropriation will be coming before you.
Okay,
sure.
Maybe. All right. Okay.
Thanks.
Stingerthal.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Mary Tingerthal. I'm the commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and you're receiving a couple of pieces for today's presentation, a brief PowerPoint presentation, a chart of our requested appropriations, and a slightly more readable version of our distribution of resources, which I will talk about as we come to it in the PowerPoint presentation. With me today is Katie Topinka, who is our legislative liaison. There may be those of you who wonder whether we have either animals or fees, and the answer would be no to both. But we do think that having a safe, affordable place to live is an important priority for Minnesota. And to that end, you'll see that our mission is to finance affordable housing for low and moderate income households while fostering strong communities. We did a presentation before the Human Services Committee on an overview of the agency, but we are somewhat split between our policy issues and our appropriations, with the appropriations being part of the economic development appropriations bill that will be before this committee. So we are here today simply to present the governor's budget, but I'm certainly happy to answer questions of any of the committee members about Minnesota housing. Moving on to slide number four, I just want to review with you very quickly the strategic priorities of Minnesota housing. The first is promoting and supporting successful home ownership. This is one of the longest running commitments of the agency. The agency is 40 years old and has for that entire time provided low-cost mortgages for first-time home buyers and also home improvement loans for existing homeowners. Second priority is to preserve federally subsidized rental housing. We have about 40,000 units of housing in Minnesota that's supported by federal rent subsidies that are attached to the building. And that includes both the Section 8 program and the Rural Development Program. Those are particularly valuable subsidies that we receive, and we're particularly interested in preserving that housing stock, first of all, because it's in generally good locations and has been well managed over a long period of time, but also because if those buildings were to go away, the rent subsidies would go away along with them. Our third priority really talks to critical needs in rental housing. We are looking with every year when we award funds for rental housing to try to be very attuned to the different kinds of housing needs for rental housing around the state. We have found, for example, that in southeastern Minnesota, there's a lot of demand for larger family rental housing, a lot of immigrants finding employment in packing houses and other industries in southeastern Minnesota, which is quite different from what we find, for example, in west central Minnesota. Our fourth priority is to prevent and end homelessness. We are closing in this year on a goal that was established in 2004 to create 4,000 units of housing that provides supportive services for individuals who have previously been homeless. And finally, preventing foreclosures and supporting community recovery. As you all know, the economic downturn took a real hit at many of our communities, high levels of foreclosures. That thankfully is now reducing, but there are still a lot of scars in communities such as North Minneapolis and the east side of St. Paul, where there's a lot of recovery left to be done, removal of vacant houses, rehabilitation to bring those communities back to where they were. Moving on to slide number five, just to give you a little overview of the kind of level of activity that we're able to accomplish in a given year. Last year, we served more than 63,000 households, provided $638 million of housing assistance of various types. Just to give you an idea of where most of our activity is focused, 78% of all the renters that were assisted had annual incomes under $20,000. 54% of the home buyers had an annual income of under $45,000, and more than 2,300 first-time home buyers that were assisted were households of color. 23% of those were households of color.
Commissioner, when you say you served 63,000 households, does that take into account the 40-some thousand units that the federal government has also, or are these the same numbers, or are they different numbers?
Many of the 40,000, not all of them, more like about 30,000, those rental assistance dollars flow through Minnesota Housing. The other 10,000 or so come through rural development, and we don't touch those. So there's overlap between those two numbers, but not complete overlap.
And is that part of the 63,000?
It is.
It is, okay.
Moving on to just give you a very, very brief overview of how we're structured. With some similarities to the zoo, we are a more of a standalone agency that has its own board of directors that's created by state statute. The management and control of the agency are vested in that board of directors, which then delegates authority to the commissioner. The members of the board are appointed by the governor, and they're appointed for four-year staggered terms, so there is always a continuity of membership on the board that reaches well beyond the term of any one governor. There are three members from Greater Minnesota, three members from the metro area by statute, and our seventh member of the board is Auditor Otto. Our operating budget is not funded by state appropriations. We fund all of our operations through earnings of our lending programs. In other words, we're able to borrow money in the capital markets and then relend it to primarily home buyers at a slightly higher interest rate, much as a bank would. Our operating costs are $25.6 million, which is about 3.2% of our total assistance provided. So we think that's a pretty reasonable operating percentage. 100% of any state appropriations that would be approved by this committee go into programs, so none of those dollars go into running the organization. Nearly all of the assistance that goes out to individuals goes through a network of private delivery partners. We do not, as an agency, own or manage any housing ourselves. For rental housing, these are private developers, either for-profit or nonprofit. And all of our lending programs on the single-family side, the borrowers actually apply through a bank that is participating, bank or a mortgage lender, and those loans are then funded by the agency. Moving on to page 7, just very, very quickly, state appropriations are about 9% of our total programmatic funding sources. Federal funds, about 25%. Agency resources, which we channel back into the programs to the extent that they're available over and above operating expenses, is about 10%. And bond proceeds, that's where we sell tax-exempt bonds and then relend those proceeds, are about 56%. Moving on to the table, and that's on page 8, and you do have a larger version of the table available. This shows the various programs that you'll see in the bill once you receive it. The first three of these programs are homeless programs, and I think rather than going into detail on the budget page at this point, I'll simply point out that our base budget request is the same for this biennium as it was in fiscal year 12 and 13. There are just three minor changes to that, which essentially reflects moving some money from a program that was previously funded largely with state dollars to funding that program with federal dollars, and that is the preservation or PARIF program. So you see that moving from 14.6 to 8.4 million. The difference in that program will be made up through the federal home program that we receive through HUD. And if you look down to the rehab loan single family program, most of the difference will be moved into that line item. The reason for that is the home program from HUD is very, very compliance heavy. And we found that it was very difficult for our rehab loan program, which are very small loans to very low-income homeowners. The compliance burden was just too big for those homeowners, and we instead have placed that compliance burden on much larger projects that often have other compliance requirements as well. The middle column of numbers, you will also see that the governor has recommended several one-time additional initiatives, and I will go over those in detail in just a moment. So, again, the base budget, same as the previous biennium, with three budget initiatives that would total an additional $13 million should they be funded. Moving on to page 9, I'll just go quickly through the budget initiatives. The first budget initiative is a $10 million one-time investment over the next biennium, which would be expected to generate about 200 units of new affordable housing. Just yesterday, I was up in Roseau with the governor hearing from Polaris and Marvin Windows. And we heard, I think, a pretty compelling story about the difficulty that Polaris and Marvin have in recruiting particularly really employees across the spectrum, all the way from management to research and development to folks who are on the assembly line, because there is a shortage of housing in Roseau, War Road, and the surrounding areas. And they told stories of folks having to live in hotels for up to a year before they're able to find suitable housing, oftentimes separated from their families while they're in that transitional type of housing situation. These dollars, should they be appropriated, would go into an existing program called the Challenge Fund. And that fund requires that at least 50% of the projects that are funded from that fund must have matching funds so that it's not just the state dollars going into them, and those matching funds have to come from non-state resources. So most typically, we will see dollars from employers and from local units of government coming in to make an overall financing package.
What kind of a dent will the $10 million make?
We anticipate that because these projects will not likely utilize some of our federal resources because of the income restrictions on those resources, that we'll see about 200 units that would be developed. What we're hearing in the Rosso War Road area, they just completed a housing study there. You know, making a dent of maybe 50 units there over the next couple years would be a meaningful addition in that case.
And but the 200 units you're talking about is a statewide investment. And what are what kind of need do you see?
Mr. Chair and members, I think it's a little early to tell exactly what the demand will be, although I've personally made similar trips in the last year to Thief River Falls and to the Worthington-Marshall area as well as the Rice County area. And in all cases, we think that there will be some significant local efforts to try to mount proposals that would compete for these funds. So I expect that we would not have difficulty placing the $10 million fairly quickly.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. And some of these, at various areas, I get a feel for what they are. In home ownership counseling, the HECAT program, is this an education program, or is this for individual homeowners, or exactly what is that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, yes, this is a largely those funds are utilized for home buyer education. We work through a statewide intermediary called the Homeownership Center, largely, that then subcontracts with counselors around the state. They develop, they've developed a curriculum called Home Stretch, which goes through a series of 8 hours of training to help people establish budgets, understand what it costs to afford a home, and really result in much more successful home ownership. We use that same delivery network for foreclosure prevention counseling, but we've been fortunate, if you can call having to do foreclosure prevention counseling fortunate, that that has largely been funded over the last 5 or 6 years with federal dollars. So most of the state-appropriated dollars will actually go to home buyer training as opposed to foreclosure prevention counseling.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, on your financial sheet here, budget proposal, just a question. Housing Trust Fund, one time of $3 million, bringing it up to $22,110, a 15.7% increase. By that, do you mean that, okay, after the 14-15 biennium, that's going to go back down to $19,111?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, this is a one-time funding request. We are not requesting an increase to the base.
I'm still hung up on the $10 million. So, is the so do we need more than 200 statewide, first of all? And secondly, are we looking at single-family homes, or are we looking at, like, apartment complexes when we talk about 200 units?
Mr. Chair, the funds would be able to be used for both single-family homeownership and for rental properties. And, in fact, the discussion yesterday in ROSO was to really take a two-part approach to doing both a single-family homeownership push as well as trying to promote the development of a rental property. So either one would be eligible, and we've had in the past examples of both of those being very successful.
So in the case like ROSO, I think there are going to be people who would be have pretty good paying jobs. How do they qualify for a subsidy like this then?
Mr. Chair, we have different guidelines based on the different programs that we are able to offer. The Challenge program, where it has an overall cap of roughly $59,000 across the state, so family earning $59,000 could qualify for a project that utilized these challenge funds. But we also talked about other initiatives that would work side by side with development using challenge funds, which may reach into our single family mortgage program, where we do have some limited opportunity to lend to non-first time home buyers now. So some of the strategies we talked about yesterday would perhaps encourage folks who are a little more established, maybe have been living in a rental property or already own a smaller, older home, moving up into a newly constructed home, thereby freeing up some units for people entering the community. So that program would allow household income up to about $86,000. So there's some range here depending on the mix of jobs and the wage levels in different communities. And we think the, you know, kind of the winning formula for each community will be a little different.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner Thingathal. That Eastside is under the radar of housing crisis, and by saying that, I just wonder that your delivery partners, is there a way? Do you know the detail of monitoring them and the result that they will accomplish? Whether that's effective enough in return?
Mr. Chair and Senator Herr. We do work with a lot of different delivery partners, and in the case of the City of St. Paul, we work very closely not only with the City of St. Paul, but some of the local community development corporations. We do that mostly through funds that we receive through the Challenge Fund, through something called something we call our Community Revitalization Program. And that does require reporting and evaluation of the impact. I know that recently the City of St. Paul, for example, has been trying to tie together the impact of various funding sources they have, either through us or through federal dollars, to make sure that the overall impact is positive in the neighborhoods and not overlapping.
Yep. And, my concern is just that the district I represent is quite diverse, too, and that I'd like to see that all groups are represented in the as your network of delivery partners. And, I'd just like to bring that to your attention.
Thank you, Senator Herr.
Continue, Commissioner.
Yes, going on to page 11. On pages 11 and 12, we outline the proposed funding initiatives that fall under the category of the Housing Trust Fund. The first would be an initiative to provide $2 million one-time investment to provide rental assistance to families that, because they don't have access to affordable housing, have really had a high level of mobility, and therefore kids have not had stability in schools. And this would allow a family to stay put for a period of up to 2 years so that the kids could get settled into school. We would be working very closely with the Department of Education and school districts to identify target schools and also target households that would likely benefit from this. We'll also be working with the private philanthropic community to evaluate the effectiveness of this program and see whether it makes sense for us to look for future funding should it prove to be cost effective, which we believe it will be. One of the things that's not very well known is that school districts are actually obligated to transport kids who do suffer from mobility of their families to their home school. It's a federal requirement. And so if we can keep people in a stable, affordable place to live, we actually save those transportation costs on the education side. So rather than spending money on buses, we'd be spending money on having people live in a stable place. On page 12, the second of the two initiatives for rental assistance, we'll be working very closely with the Department of Corrections to provide rental assistance for those who are exiting our correction facilities and reentering the community. What the Department of Corrections has told us is that lack of stable housing is one of the top five factors for ex-offenders to basically go back to jail. They don't find a stable place to live. They become homeless. Their lives become less stable, and they're not able to maintain their commitments to turning their lives around. Just to give you an idea of cost effectiveness here, if we can avoid recidivism, the annual cost to house an offender in prison is $31,000. The annual cost of rental assistance to give them a stable place to live is between $5,500 and $7,000. So definitely the preferred way to go, not to mention the fact that it's a better place for people to be living in the community rather than in our correctional facilities. On page 13 is just a list of the program areas that...
Excuse me, Madam Commissioner. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, so going to this reentry rental assistance program, I've toured... Project Pride and Living has a program in North Minneapolis where they have several duplexes that they bought, rehabbed, did a great job. They have some ex-offenders living in there. They're partnering with the Network for Better Futures, which is a reentry program that helps people get stable housing, job training, education, and they have some great programs getting the – usually it's dads with kids. But we have a abundance in North Minneapolis and in other areas in the center of city, and so I'm wondering if you are working on getting and finding housing and affordable housing for people coming back so they can go in their own communities and not always in North Minneapolis.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick, it's a great question, and what I can tell you is that we administer a very large rental assistance program through our Housing Trust Fund and through our Bridges program, which is for those who have suffered mental illness. And we work in administering those with administrators throughout the state of Minnesota, and we would expect to tap into that same network and identify those social service providers that are interested and willing to work with the Department of Corrections to find locations to house folks throughout the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a follow-up question. Interested is the key word that you used, because you said social service workers that are interested in working, and there are a lot of good ones, and there are some good ones around the Seven County metro area, but And again, it's the Department of Corrections. But again, you have a lot of counties and areas that, you know, they might not have the jobs, and so that is a legitimate issue. They don't have the jobs available, and so it doesn't make sense to provide, you know, a lot of housing when there's just not the jobs there for some of these offenders. But is there any way we can entice and encourage some of the other areas where they are not taking even some housing for some people that are disabled, let alone offenders? Is there any way, or do you have any, are you looking at any ways to encourage and entice those who maybe aren't interested in having housing for some of these different programs?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick, that's certainly an issue I will take back. It's not, since this is a just recently proposed program, we've just really begun discussions with the Department of Corrections and setting up the guidelines should the program be funded. But that's certainly a concern that we're happy to work on and happy to get started ahead of time, getting more organizations to think about developing this expertise.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
On page 13, I won't go into a lot of detail, but when you look at your budget document, you'll see some clustering of different programs into particular budget program areas. And this chart on page 13 really just shows you where the different programs fall in those program categories. Moving on to number 14. Our development and redevelopment section primarily is comprised of our Housing Challenge Program, which we've already talked about to some degree. We use this for both rental and owner-occupied housing. And as I mentioned earlier, workforce housing is available for folks earning up to a household income of $59,000. We leverage about $7.50 of non-state resources for every $1 of appropriated dollars that we bring to the table. And again, this is primarily used by private developers and housing authorities. In our supportive housing and homelessness prevention area, there are three primary categories: the Housing Trust Fund, which is now being used primarily for rental assistance; the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program, which is literally used to prevent homelessness by providing families that are about to suffer homelessness things like a damage deposit or first month's rent that can allow them to get into a stable rental situation. And the Bridges Program is also a rental assistance program that serves those who are mentally ill.
I'll be real quick here because I know I'm missing another meeting right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, so going back to that emergency assistance program, is that the equivalent, or is that you then flow through to counties for county emergency assistance, or is this a different program that people can either, you know, that do you partner with the counties on this, or is this passed through to the counties?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick, this is coordinated in connection with the continuum of care organizations that are available throughout the state, and there's a variety of ways that this gets delivered, but it's talked about in the continuum of care regions, and they really recommend who the applicants are for those funds, whether it's the county or another social service agency.
Thank you.
Commissioner, you got a bunch of slides left, and we've got about 3 minutes. Can you finish them, or would you like to come back on Monday?
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to jump to the punchline if that would be agreeable for the committee, and I'm certainly happy to come back at any time if there are members that would wish a little more time on our budget.
All right, let's do the punchline.
And, all right.
If I hear from the people that aren't here, because the reason I'm suggesting it is because there's a lot of committee members that aren't here, and they might want to hear it. So if they do, I'll let you know, okay? So
happy to come back.
Okay, all right.
So going to page 21, I just want to really wrap up and talk about Minnesota Housing and why I think it warrants your support. We've been around for 40 years. No state appropriations go to operating expenses. Investments are made in communities across the state through local businesses, banks and developers, social service agencies. Investments, every one of them, leverages both private and public resources. Savings to the state through supportive housing and through rehabilitation, where we're allowing people to stay in their homes. And while state appropriations are only 9% of our overall programmatic budget, they are vital to us being able to target the funds to where they're needed the most. So with that, Senator, I will cease my presentation for today.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Sandy tells me that Monday is a holiday for everybody but the legislature, including the agencies. And just give me a sense of what if we called you up and said, come back on Monday. Would people be here, or how would that work?
Senator, it may keep me from spending some additional money in Lake and Cook County, but I could certainly be back on Monday afternoon.
They're not in my district anyway. But give me another sense for everybody who's working for you. Are they all on vacation?
Senator, or Mr. Chair, Tanya or our Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner for Policy, and I will be working on Monday. So we could certainly come back if there are some questions.
And
do
you think the other agencies are they letting everybody off that date? And if we call them up and say, come in and testify, what do you think?
I think if you let them know in advance, Senator, they would be happy to be here.
I was hoping that would be the answer. Okay. Further questions of the witnesses? And if not, like I said, some people may want you to come back, and I'm sure we'll have you back when we get the bill in front of us anyway. So with that, thank you, everybody, and thank you those who stuck around. You all get a prize. We'll figure out what that is later. And meeting adjourned.
I got a bill that you can...